Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, why more scientists should be women. My friend and colleague Steph Curtis recently told me about a science project her middle school daughter was working on with a classmate.
It was a pulley system.
When Steph's daughter and her classmate were finished, their friends were pretty impressed with what they'd built.
And they each built one, and then they're standing by their pulley systems. And so two of the other students walked over, and they looked at the pulley systems, and they looked at the boy that my daughter is friends with and said, "Those are cool. Those are really great pulley systems." And my daughter said, "They thought that he had built them." And she said, "I was standing right there." And then when she kind of questioned the girl about, "Well, that's mine," the girl said, "Oh, I thought you were just helping him out by handing him parts and that he was building them." And my daughter didn't know what to do with it. She didn't feel angry. She was shocked and she was uncomfortable, and she was just trying to mull through what happened here. Why did they attribute my work to my friend? We're both obviously standing right by our projects.
I wanted our roundtablers and you to hear that because I think it reminds us of how early girls start to hear messages that they aren't meant or expected to be scientists or even interested in science. Today, as we talk about the challenges of attracting and keeping more women in science, I'd like to hear from you via social media, especially if you work in a scientific field. If you're a woman in science, what kinds of obstacles and rewards have you encountered? And if you're the parent of daughters, what are you doing to encourage their interest in science? So if you work in the scientific field as a woman, I'd like to hear about the rewards and the obstacles of being in this field. And if you're the parent of daughters, what are you doing? Maybe something out of the ordinary to encourage their interest in science. You can tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Our roundtablers today, Erin Carlson is a professor of chemistry at the University of Minnesota. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much.
Relyn Hardtke is a professor of physics at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
And Maggie Kurth-Baker is a senior science writer for 538. Always good to see you. Welcome back. Good
Thanks
to have you
Thanks a
here.
Lot.
What do you take away from that that story, that anecdote that Steph Curtis shared with us about her daughter?
That I am going to have to hold myself back from chewing out other children when my daughters get into grade school. I don't know. I mean, it's a really difficult thing, and it's something that I feel like I kind of experienced myself. I have a degree in anthropology and a degree in journalism, and I originally went to college intending to go to med school, but felt that I wasn't good enough at math. And now when I look back at it, I got B's in math, which is not actually bad.
No, which is really good.
Right?
Right.
But I considered that my bad subject and that I was not good enough and that I wasn't going to be able to hack it.
Did anybody tell you that, or was that what you were telling yourself?
I don't know. I don't remember, honestly. I just remember that by the time I was in college, it was what I was telling myself.
Mm.
So I think both of those things are true, is that we get girls and women get messages that they're not expected to be as good as the boys and the men. And so there's a lot of implicit assumptions made. But also research shows that women and girls opt out of non-traditional fields as soon as they stop getting all A's. Maybe a couple B's are okay. But women will self-select out because they think they're not good enough. Whereas, very generally speaking, men will stay with it even if they have to retake courses because they didn't pass them the first time. They'll take them multiple times. But women have a different standard for what it means to be successful in STEM fields, and they self-select out. But there's also this messaging that happens.
Well, and the message is actually has a name. So the story that you just had us listen to is that's a classic example of what's called the Matilda effect. And so the Matilda effect is the phenomenon in which women scientists' contributions can be overlooked or misattributed to their male colleagues. And so obviously this starts extremely young, and there's many instances of it. And so one of the classic examples is the scientist Rosalind Franklin, mm-hmm. was actually one of the scientists that helped to discover the structure of DNA, but most people have only ever heard of Watson and Crick,
boy, that's for sure,
our male colleagues.
Right.
And Watson and Crick were dealing with Tinker Toy models, literally, and they had it wrong until they secretly saw Rosalind Franklin's X-ray crystallography work.
No way. She never
knew that they saw her work, and then that's how they figured out how to reconfigure their Tinker Toy model.
So when you say secretly saw...
They were given it by the guy who was her boss, basically?
Yes.
Yeah, under the table.
So if the
and
third person...
And then also once when they visited the lab, so they saw it twice.
So if the third person in that story had been a man, do you think there would have been... more collegiate, more, hey, we saw your work and we want you to come in here on the process of where we go from here.
Absolutely. There's always competition for credit, but Watson in particular was very derogatory about
Have you ever
Rosalind
read
Franklin.
The yeah. memoir on that?
I haven't, and I
oh,
will.
Oh, God, Watson's memoir. Like, this is him writing about himself. It makes himself appear to be a... words I cannot say on the radio.
A jerk?
Sure, we'll go with that.
A credit?
Yeah.
A credit,
yeah, I mean, just the way that he talks about her, and like he spends a good chunk of the book like deriding her appearance and like minimizing her and basically talking about how she was worthless.
Calling her nicknames behind her back.
Yeah.
But there is a book that has been rewritten from Franklin's point of view that gives him a better view of what happened. But
so yeah, it was really interesting.
It was an atrocity.
I don't want us to miss the Matilda, the effect of the Matilda effect either. I mean, if Steph's daughter Bee had not felt like something was wrong, this is the kind of thing that you internalize, Erin, from a pretty young age and maybe don't know that there's anything wrong with this without even really realizing as you age that you believe that too.
Absolutely. The messages that we receive, whether or not they're explicit or implicit, right, are incredibly effectual on our ultimate thoughts about our own abilities. And so, you know, you can kind of think of your ability to withstand that kind of input as our armor, and eventually there's enough chinks in it that you just break and kind of internally think that those messages are true. And, you know, that might perhaps explain why, you know, women who don't get an A in every class just abandon a course or a field of study, because I don't think that the messaging, you know, necessarily from the professors is going to be, well, you didn't get an A, you should leave. And then this man who got a C, he should clearly stay. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything explicit going on like that in general.
Relin, what do you tell your students about it? You're in physics. You're mm-hmm. teaching young, budding physicists. What do you say about
mm-hmm.
these standards? Okay, and engineers, these standards that you know your female students are holding themselves to.
I think it's really important to have discussions like this because a lot of people aren't aware of this research. And so whenever I mention this, you can see light bulbs go on and the young women in the room start nodding their heads. And a lot of them, so I teach a gender issues and science course, and a lot of them are seniors by the time they get to take it. And so a lot of these young women are saying, I wish somebody had told me this 3 years ago or 4 years ago. I would still be a pre-vet major, or I would still be a math major, or I would still be a chemistry major. Once this is brought to light, once they see the standards they're holding themselves to, once they hear about implicit bias, the light goes on. And so I think we need to let young people know that this is happening. And so I have two daughters and we talk about this, and we're trying to get that message out. So, for example, we do a Girls in Science event, and a lot of other universities and community colleges do as well. If we can get this message out, if we can let people know what the research says, that helps a lot, and they feel so validated.
Doesn't this also hold for kids of color? I mean...
Oh, absolutely.
Everything about this is intersectional.
Yes. Yeah, and I think here it's actually also important to point out the imposter syndrome. So I know I'm putting names to a lot of things, but these are all things that have been studied and discussed thoroughly. And we recently at the University of Minnesota had a workshop where, you know, graduate students were introduced to the idea of the imposter syndrome, and the vast majority of them had never heard of it before. And it's, you know, essentially the idea that you're an imposter and you're tricking everyone into thinking you're good enough. And again, speaking generally, this is suffered by more women. And the fact that a lot of the women didn't even know this existed or that other people felt this way is amazing to me. And it's critical that we inform them about things so they don't feel so isolated.
And I think it's a moment to say there's a difference between self-doubt. Everybody experiences those moments of, am I good enough to do what I've signed on to do? And the imposter syndrome, yes, which is that pervasive feeling like I don't belong here and everybody around me is going to figure that out.
Right.
Right. Have you ever experienced that, Meg? I bet you haven't.
Yes.
No. No, the imposter syndrome?
Oh, yes.
Really?
Oh, very much.
Why? Give me a little bit about the circumstances of that.
So I think that I definitely felt a little bit of that. So when you're freelancing, which I did for a decade, there is sort of a there's this Kurt Vonnegut quote about how if you can do a, you know, half job of anything, you're a one-eyed man in the kingdom of the blind.
Yeah.
And exactly. I feel like there's definitely that sort of true for freelancing where, like, if you are turning things in, copy in on time and generally without needing a lot of edits, like, everybody is super excited about it. And so I went for a good chunk of my career not having much editing done to my work because it was clearing this bar that was a little higher than what people expected for freelance work. And then I started writing for places like the New York Times Magazine and for 538. And
About science.
Yeah. And I became this kind of, you know, I moved from being like this big fish in a small pool to the average sized fish in the other pool. And all of a sudden I'm getting all these edits back. And I just felt, oh, my God, they've figured out that I'm a moron. And I'm not good at writing. And everyone knows it now. And oh, no. And it took me a really long time to figure out that that is completely normal. You know, I had the same thing when I was writing my book, and I only realized, like, after I had turned in my draft and was talking to other people, that no one turns the draft of the book in on time.
and everyone knows it. And doesn't get any edits,
right? Right, yeah. Like, that is, you know, I've definitely had a lot of struggle with that.
And I just want to point out that this is true more so for women and students of color, that they chronically underestimate their ability to succeed in STEM fields or non-traditional fields. So they've been replicated many times, for example, with math test. They will statistically underestimate how they will do at a math test. They'll take the test, they'll have completed it, and then they statistically significantly underestimate how well they have done, even though they've completed it. Whereas, generally speaking, white males tend to slightly overestimate how well they will do and have done. So there's just a difference in our perception of our potential for success and a lack of perspective on how much we've already accomplished.
Well, and isn't there a couple of studies where they have started out before, like with kids of color, like started yes. out before and kind of told them, given the pep talk of like, you can totally do this and you know this material and this is something you're really good at. And then they do better.
True.
Erin, how do you deal with this with the young women and the students of color in your classes in chemistry? That's a very competitive scientific field, especially in academics.
It is very competitive. I mean, I think one of the things that I try to do is be a role model, right? That's a critically important thing for students to see. And really, in the course of my training, I've had a number of critical female role models. I also try very intentionally to engage my women students and really make sure that I'm always nominating for them for awards when it's appropriate and intentionally trying to raise them up and really consciously make efforts to do that. Because the studies show that even women often forget to do those things for their own students.
That's exactly where I was going. And I think other women in field, Relan, this is probably something you think about as well. Like, not just for your students, but peer to peer, maybe in the academic environment.
Yeah, what I want to point out is that we all grow up in the same culture, and it's a culture that devalues girls and women. And so people are often confused about why women also unintentionally, but write shorter reference letters for women candidates, or why they have the same gender biases as men do. It's because we grow up in the same culture, and so people often think that women should be immune from participating in any of these gender disparities when it comes to supporting women. But we're surrounded by a culture that devalues girls and women, or that assumes the great work is always done by men. And there's so many examples of that. And so I think we need to talk about the presence of implicit bias among all of us. It's not something that men do to women. It's something society creates and generates for women.
And it's very difficult for women to basically excise that when, as you're saying, you're kind of saturated in it as you grow up. It's internalized.
And so when women and girls don't do well, they blame themselves. Whereas more often when boys and men struggle, they blame outside factors.
How much do you think, I want to talk about why women end up getting STEM degrees and then end up also leaving the field. And I wonder if, I know there's probably a number of different reasons for this. Do you think that is part of the reason, that there is not enough peer-to-peer support in these companies and in these academic environments for women, between women?
I don't want to ever make women responsible for the success or failures of other women.
This is not a, if you were better, more, this is just a, are you aware that this may be a big deal? So go ahead.
So my department happens to be very supportive, and my campus is very supportive. We're very successful with women in physics and engineering and chemistry and math. But I think if we're all made more aware of implicit bias, that helps a lot. So people know that they don't want to be called sexist, right? And they don't want to be called racist. And so you can't really, and we're not really talking about those overt things anymore. Those blatant, well, I wish we didn't have to talk about the blatant things. The blatant things still happen some places. But everybody sort of needs to be more aware of this implicit bias and not be afraid of talking about it and not feel like they're being attacked when we talk about it.
I would also say that, I mean, it's important to understand that implicit bias exists in the context of a really, really competitive field. Mm-hmm. I mean, we often think about there not being enough people majoring in STEM, but when you're talking about like tenure scientific jobs, you're talking about a job where you get like 450 applications for six jobs. That's happened at Cal Academy a couple years ago. I mean, this is something, and it's something that affects the STEM fields that have the most women more. So, for instance, here, if you're looking at like the biomedical field, it has, let's see, only 7.6% will find permanent employment within 3 years.
Okay, so that's also going to contribute to the fact that a lot of women leave STEM or don't never use their degrees or leave a STEM field fairly early.
Well, there's also a major contribution there that I don't want to emphasize its importance, but the biological clock plays a part because it makes it more difficult for women to follow the traditional path that's accepted for entry into something like academics. And so there's, you know, we routinely have hundreds of applicants for one position in our department. And if there's anything that makes an applicant look different or like they weren't completely committed from the first second they started in science, that's not beneficial to their application package.
Specifically, what isn't that you're planning on having children?
No, that if you took a couple of years off, for example, or if you, you know,
really
just weren't totally sure what you wanted to do and it's clear from your CV that you meandered a little bit.
Well, and it also, I mean, when I was looking at this STEM field, the job market problem, this is something that's changed over time. So, like, if you, back when most of the grads from STEM were white men, it was an easier job market to get into, and it was easier to start out and get grants when you were young. So in 1980, more than half of the National Institute of Health competitive research grants went to scientists under the age of 40. In 2003, fewer than 17% of those grants went to scientists under the age of 40.
Wow.
So we've ramped up the number of women and people of color who are graduating with STEM degrees, and now there's no jobs for them.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation here about women in science. And I'm asking you, as we discuss this with two scientists and a science writer and a scientist with a degree in anthropology, not practicing, Maggie.
I would not say a scientist, but yeah.
Maggie Kurth-Baker, by the way, one of our roundtablers. She's a senior science writer for 538. Relyn Hardke with us. She's a professor of physics at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. And Aaron Carlson is a professor of chemistry at the University of Minnesota. As you hear us kind of move through some of these questions and obstacles for why more women are not in science, why more women aren't sticking it out in scientific fields, I want to hear from you as well. If you're a woman in science, what kinds of obstacles, and tell me about the rewards as well, are you encountering? And if you're the parent of daughters, what are you doing to encourage their interest in science? And maybe it's something kind of unusual. I mean, maybe you send them off to a really cool camp, or you're doing something neat, you know, in your household or something. So talk to me about that on Twitter. It's at CarrieNPR. Relyn, you were going
to
say.
I just wanted to go back to what Aaron was saying about the structure of work and family. So our structure of work, our expectations at work, are based on a 1950s model.
Exactly.
Where there was one breadwinner and there was a stay-at-home spouse, traditionally the woman, and we still have the same expectations for work hours, work productivity. But most women in STEM fields are actually partnered with another professional, often somebody else in STEM. And so a lot of women in STEM don't have a stay-at-home partner, but we still have the same expectations of working overtime or weekends, especially to get tenure, to get research grants. And so I actually think it's a structure of work issue. And I've actually had people say, I don't think women can have it all. It's too hard. And I was like, men have it all the time. In fact, men with children do better in STEM fields than men without. And so I think we need to talk about the structure of work and work expectations as well.
This is what is something I was thinking about too, Aaron, when you said you get all these applications and the people considering the applicants may look askance if you've got a CV that meanders a little bit. I mean, the other interpretation of that is you're a more well-rounded person, right?
Sure. No,
and
it's, I mean, there's
you have
lots
some
of
life experience, you know, and okay, it doesn't fit into the structure that we think it should in the way we've been used to looking at this.
The problem, I mean, and of course, those are really important things to think about. And from an intellectual discussion, it's easy to say, well, we should obviously, you know, value those things. But when it comes down to actual logistics, you know, we're offering someone $1 million to come start a research group. We don't want them to, you know, have that little thing that might make them different that would waste that, you know, that investment, right? So there's parts and pieces and parts to it that just make it hard to put as much value on some of those other softer skills from a practical standpoint, but we absolutely have to find ways to do it.
Why was there loud laughter from this side of the round table when I said it makes you a more well-rounded person to have meandered a little bit, Maggie?
Well, I think, like, so I was thinking about this because partly because of a female mathematician that I ran across while I was kind of researching for this, that we have, like, all these narratives of guys who had really non-traditional paths to becoming great inventors, right?
Yeah.
There
Good
are
point.
Not a
Good
lot
point.
Of stories about women that same way. You know, I mean, we are sort of expected to do the all A's thing, and like that's how you get ahead, and you have to get ahead, particularly if you're like a woman of color, you have to work like three times as hard as everybody else to prove that you're as good. And
True.
It's really rare to find those stories about women and women of color who kind of took these alternate paths.
Yeah,
and Austin, that gives you like a really different perspective. So there's this woman named Miranda Cheng, who's a Taiwanese mathematician at the University of Amsterdam. And her backstory is so awesome. She dropped out of high school at 16 to play in a punk band. And
I already love her.
I know. It's such a great story. And she thought she wanted to go into literature and then got into college because her scores were better in math. She kind of went into a math degree thinking she could transfer into literature later, which is also such a great backstory. And then realized she wasn't good at literature and she was good at math. And now she's doing all of this stuff that I cannot possibly begin to explain, but involving string theory. And she's this very respected mathematician internationally.
When we hire people, there's not often explicit conversations about not being, or nobody would say, I don't want a well-rounded person. But there's this implicit idea that it's not that important in science. So there is some truth to some stereotypes. And they, like, for in science, I think it's easier for somebody to get away with being a jerk, perhaps, like a Dr. Watson. And so there's not the same social codes or the social expectations. And so, you know, interpersonal skills are a little less valued. And so I don't think that gains us as much as it would in other fields. There's this great underground game that some people have. It's called sort of gender hiring bias bingo. But there's code phrases. Anyone who's been on a hiring committee has heard phrases like, well, I just don't think she would fit in here. Or
and break the code of that. What does that mean?
It means she's not like us.
A bunch of white men sitting on the committee making the decision.
Probably. Yeah. But I'm not even sure that those people are aware.
Right. Got
that. That what they're saying is a code for
Understood.
Something else.
See, I don't think a lot of this is malicious. Now,
agreed.
I'm probably going to hear about this on Twitter, but I think that's what you mean when you talk about the implicit bias of this,
right.
is not we are going to block all women from getting into this company or getting into this university. It's just it's outside our experience and it doesn't feel right. And I can't really explain why it doesn't feel right.
I mean, in grad school, there was a professor who said, I'm never going
to
mentor a woman graduate student because they just
said
get
this
married.
To you?
No, actually, he was saying it to another professor because they're just going to get married and have babies. So, I mean, those people still exist, but I think they're getting more rare. But if people are aware that a woman who's applying is young or just got married, they do. I have heard their marriage status discussed or whether or not they have children discussed, which is technically illegal, but it happens. And so I do think that plays a role in some of these decisions.
Well, and I want to take this further because we're talking a lot about hiring, but actually retention and fostering of women's careers is a critical issue.
Right.
And so I'm actually on a committee at the University of Minnesota right now that's talking extensively about this issue and how to create the best possible environment for diversity at the University of Minnesota. And one of the things we've discussed actually is the fact that, bringing back my point on being a mentor and trying to make sure that, you know, I'm doing all these things that help others succeed, those things all take time. And so one of the things that's not valued enough in women and other underrepresented groups is how much time and effort is spent on things like service and mentoring and informal mentoring. And so that actually takes away from our official job duties. And so one of the discussions we're having is how to place value on those other things that, you know, we do in our careers and create an environment where, you know, those things are valued and help foster, you know, the careers of women and people of color through acknowledging those other responsibilities.
I mean, and yeah, I mean, I think it, you have to kind of look at this big picture of all these things sort of stacking up on top of each other, right? I mean, you have the data that shows that, you know, whether they intend to or not, male partners of women who work don't do as
right.
much work at home, don't do as much work with the kids. So you have that plus the expectation that you are going to work hours like you have a non-working spouse, plus you have the fact that, you know, even controlling for educational level experience and industry, women earn 9% less with a PhD than men do. Then you have the hours. Then you have the difficulty of finding a job because 500 people are applying for the job you want. You know, all those things come together and eventually it starts to look less appealing. I mean, when I was looking at this, you see fewer women going into academia
mm-hmm.
and more women going into industry. Jobs with PhDs, industry jobs in science, so like working for a pharmaceutical research lab, because those jobs actually offer a little bit more flexibility than academia does.
And pay well.
Right.
I'm sure, and pay better.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. We're contemplating women in science, talking about how to attract more young women into science and more Americans of color into science, what to do and what to be thinking about of how to retain them, and what you can do as parents to encourage that scientific spark with your kids. I think that's an essential part of this. If you missed the beginning of the roundtable, go back and listen on the podcast to this anecdote that Steph Curtis told about her daughter. It kind of set the tone this morning for the roundtable. We'll get a look at the latest news. When we come back, I want to talk to our roundtablers about this idea of having to prove your competence again and again. Women in science find this happens a lot. I want to ask our roundtablers if they've run into this. And I'd love to hear from you. You can tweet me at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. We'll get a look at the latest.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. President Trump says his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, is right to ask for immunity in exchange for talking about Russia. Trump this morning tweeted, Mike Flynn should ask for immunity in that this is a witch hunt. Flynn's attorney says the retired general is in discussions with the House and Senate Intelligence Committees on receiving immunity from unfair prosecution. Trump's top lawyer is inviting a group of Republican and Democratic lawmakers to view classified information at the White House. The outreach comes as the Trump administration faces new questions about possible political interference involving investigations into Russia meddling. Vladimir Putin's press secretary says relations between the U.S. and Russia are at a very low ebb, perhaps exceeding the hostility between Washington and Moscow during the Cold War. Dmitry Peskov tells ABC reports of Russian hacking against the U.S. political system are, quote, fake news. As the U.S.-led coalition ramps up the fight against the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria, claims of civilian casualties caused by airstrikes have spiked dramatically. The toll, both in infrastructure destroyed and in lives lost, has the potential to undercut U.S. military victories, stoking resentment and a backlash that could play into the hands of the militants. And SpaceX has launched its first recycled rocket. It's the biggest leap yet in the company's bid to drive down costs and speed up flights. The Falcon 9 rocket blasted off from Florida's Kennedy Space Center last night on the historic reflight. It's the first time SpaceX founder Elon Musk has tried to fly a salvaged booster. The first stage landed on an ocean platform almost a year ago after a launch for NASA. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
Later on All Things Considered, salt. It keeps Minnesota roads drivable in winter, but can wind up polluting lakes and streams. Looking for creative ways to cut back on road salt, plus all the day's news, I'm Tom Cran. Join me starting at 3.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, we'll wrap up this week's international news on the global edition of the Friday News Roundup. America looks for a better relationship with Turkey, and the UK files for divorce from the EU.
This is an historic moment from which there can be no turning back.
The global edition of the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
1A each weekday at 10 o'clock in the morning here on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Support comes from Clearway Minnesota, offering the reminder that nearly all smokers start by age 18, and more than half will die from diseases due to smoking. But if kids don't start, smoking stops. More at StopTheStartMN.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation today where we're talking about women in science, what kinds of obstacles, the rewards of a career in science, how to attract more young women into science, more Americans of color into science, and then this idea of building that spark in your daughters of science and not letting it be extinguished by a lot of the messages that we get in our culture, because they're kind of unavoidable, this idea that women just aren't natural mathematicians or scientists. That's why we've got two scientists and a science writer on the roundtable today. Erin Carlson is a professor of chemistry at the University of Minnesota. Relin Hardke is a professor of physics at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. And Maggie Kurth Baker is a senior science writer for 538. Maggie, I want to talk about this idea that women fall, and I don't even know if women are so aware of this, but this idea that getting the job and meeting standards often isn't enough, that you have to come back and prove your competence again and again, because it sounds like the skepticism about your qualifications and your knowledge follows you around to a certain degree.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we're talking about the Taiwanese mathematician. I mean, I think that there's a lot of women and there's a lot of people of color who, if they didn't have the straight A's through high school perfect SAT score, would assume, well, that's it, and not turn around and say, like, you know, 5 years after you should have graduated, well, maybe I can go back to college and Right. Maybe this is something I can do. Like, you assume that ship has passed. You assume you're not the smart person. And, you know, that's a really hard thing to overcome, because it's partly not just inside their heads, right? Like, it's also based in what these hiring people are expecting of them. And having to work twice as hard for the same opportunities, or even, you know, maybe not the same opportunities, like, that takes a toll on people.
You know, Rylan, it kind of goes with what you were saying about women who are perceived as accomplished are perceived that way because they worked in teams or they asked for help. And you say, you know, you don't hear about the singular female genius the way you do with men.
Right. So when I was at MIT, if men were doing really well, they were brilliant. They were geniuses. But if women were doing really well, people attributed that to them being willing to ask for more help or working harder. And so there's an attribution difference even when men and women are both doing very well.
What are the implications of that?
So think about CRISPR, so that technology of gene editing,
yes.
Right? Okay, so the woman behind that is Jennifer Doudna. And I think about the difference in framing of her versus, like, if it was, you know, John Doudna, he would be a genius. He would be a great man history kind of framing, like the singular person who made this thing happen. And she's framed as part of a team.
Because?
I don't know. But that's how that story is always told.
As Jennifer knew how to bring together great minds and...
And there's all these people that did this and all of these different groups that are working on this thing together. And she is the person quoted, but she's not framed as this genius that made this thing happen.
Aaron, when Maggie brought this up in our break, that you kind of shook your head and said, that makes me so mad.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it would be really frustrating, you know, to have some essentially brilliant idea that you had not get you the credit that it would if you were a man instead of a woman, on a very different scale, but something that still really bugged me. When I was first interviewing for jobs, I was fortunate to have a number of interviews, and I cannot count the number of times when people are like, oh, wow, you have a lot of interviews. It must be because you're a woman.
Oh.
And I was just so insulted. Like, yes, I could have been sitting around for the last 15 years and had this many interviews. You know, it's just...
So when we do, there's a lot of research that shows when you take the names off of materials, women do just as well as men. But when you include gendered names or when you include ethnic names, people expect twice as many publications or three times as many publications. It is clear in the research that there's this difference in expectations, and women and people of color really do have to do more in order to be considered as qualified. And they're just not respected, as Maggie was saying, for their contributions. Like, Jocelyn Bell Burnell was this young graduate student who discovered pulsars. Her advisor made fun of her because it was considered unphysical at the time. She turned out to be right. He got the Nobel Prize and she didn't, because he was the lab leader, but she did the work. But on the other hand, Liza Meitner, who did all the theoretical work and discovery of fission, was not given the Nobel Prize. Otto Hahn was, because they said he did the actual work and she just had the theory. So they'll cut it any way possible to exclude women from credit, either because they just did the theory or they just did the experimental research.
There's a lot of those Nobel Prizes that get handed out after the woman who was involved in it conveniently dies.
What? What are you really saying here?
Jocelyn Bell Burnell is still alive, by the way.
Well, there you go.
She's
still
eligible.
I'm thinking about cases like like Rosalind Franklin and like Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who's
a hero of mine.
Who's a person who basically created the way that we can tell distance in space. And she died before the Nobel Prize was handed out that was based on her discovery and that went to somebody else.
But without her work, we wouldn't even have understood that the universe is expanding. And Edwin Hubble gets all that credit.
All the credit.
And the Hubble Space Telescope. But it was really her work and then Nancy Grace Roman who helped NASA launch the Hubble Space Telescope. It was really women behind these big projects.
I love the Leavitt story because she, and I'm probably mispronouncing her last name, but like she was paid, what was at the time, servant's wages for a job that was considered clerical as like support staff for the real scientists.
This is kind of the Hidden Figures story, I'm reading the book right now. That's
there are so many of those things. And one of my favorite things about this is that later in her life, there was one time when she was interviewed in the census that she wrote her job as astronomer. And it's such just this great moment of just like, yeah, no, that's what I do.
Owning it.
Yep.
Right. Whether you believe it or not.
And that was not her title. She was not considered an astronomer. Like the fact that she put that down as her job description is this moment of rebellion that is really, really cool.
And Pickering at Harvard intentionally hired all these women because he knew he could pay them
less.
Almost nothing.
Yeah.
Okay, so this we could have our audience walk away feeling really discouraged and depressed about this because now we've talked about everything that's wrong here. Let's talk about some of the change. Is it Aaron, Rel, and Maggie? Is it so incremental that we are not really seeing the effects of it yet? Or
no, I think there's a lot of areas for improvement. But you know, I want to highlight, for example, that almost 30% of the faculty in my department are women. That's a huge change and is much higher than the national average.
That's great.
That makes a big difference. And I believe that studies show that once you reach a threshold of 30%, the underrepresented group stops feeling like tokens and really feel that they're a part of the community. And I feel that very strongly in my department, for example.
Well, and what's the percentage in your department? Do you know?
In my department, it's about, in faculty?
Yeah.
Oh, it's about 1/3 women. We are exceptional in the country. There's actually almost half of physics departments in the country that still have no women faculty.
Wow. And what do you think the universities tell themselves about that? We just can't find...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, what's the...
So there's a great story where a prominent physics department said... or a prominent math department said, there's just not any women qualified to be at our institution. And so a woman from physics sent out an email and asked people to submit names of women who might be qualified to be a math professor at this institution. And the list came back fairly long. And so she submitted it to the math department. And so it's a great story.
What else is changing, do you think, that might be helpful? Hopeful here.
I think I'm really hopeful watching communities of color start to create their own ways of reaching out to kids. So there's tons of like YouTube videos and organizations and websites that like you can go to if you are a family of color and you want your kids to get into science. One of my favorites is this video series called Crazy Aunt Lindsay that's like Mr. Wizard, except it's a black woman, and she does these really fantastic little experiments with kids and gets them really excited about science, and it's a really great program.
And I want to point out that we know it's not a genetic difference. So almost half of bachelor's degrees in math and chemistry in the U.S. are now earned by women. People used to think it was math.
Did you feel like you had to say that because people still believe that, Ron?
Yes, I do.
People still believe that?
I mean, Lawrence Summers, as president of Harvard, announced it.
Who?
Sorry. And also people believe that the way things are in the U.S. is the way they are everywhere. In Italy, almost half of PhD physicists are women. So there's not a genetic difference. And, genetics, evolution doesn't happen over 30, 40 years. It is a social construct. And we can change our social construct.
I do want to say this about internationally. So when I was reading up on research on pay and promotion discrimination, Mexico, France, South Africa, a lot of the European countries are still looking percentage-wise the way we do. So it's good to hear that about Italy.
Mm-hmm.
But the norm still seems to be a lot of work to do.
there's a lot of variation by country. A lot of variation.
There's one thing I wanted to bring up that is the work of a female scientist mm-hmm. that actually can help other female
okay,
scientists.
Good.
So Cynthia Dwork is doing all this really interesting work with algorithms, the kinds of things that people use to filter out hiring applications, and trying to figure out how to work concepts of fairness into these algorithms. So, for instance, companies, when they hire, will use an algorithm to sort through applications, and that will often weed out people who do not have the right kind of background,
quote unquote,
that tends to favor white men. And so she's trying to figure out how you can have these computer programs that make the hiring job easier without ending up excluding people who went to tribal college, who went to HBCUs, who, you know, like have these backgrounds that are different.
Do you know what kind of change that could open up?
Oh, huge.
If she can do that?
Huge.
That is huge.
Yeah.
And, I know people don't realize. Resources, but, you know.
Well, and people don't realize, like, how much algorithms play a role
right.
in their lives. I mean, I don't know if you've read Weapons of Math Destruction.
Uh-uh.
Oh, my gosh. You need to read Weapons of Math Destruction. It's a really, really good book about the ways that the use of ostensibly objective mathematical modeling can actually increase inequality in our lives.
I'm still working on Ed Yong's book, right, which is fantastic. Maggie's got me on a science reading course here, which is great. Okay, so I usually close my Friday roundtables with a reading recommendation, but we've gotten a lot of good book titles here in the course of the conversation. I want to ask you about a woman scientist, and this is kind of in the spirit of Hidden Figures, contemporary or historical, who has not gotten the due she deserves. We have actually thrown out a lot of names, but one more, if you will. Maggie, who would that be for you?
I'm going to do that, and this is another name I don't know how to pronounce exactly, but Mona Hanna Atisha.
Uh-huh.
She is a pediatrician who runs the pediatric medical residency program at the Hurley Medical Center in Flint, Michigan. And she is the person that figured out what was going on with the lead levels in Flint. And she did that by going through, like, they got all of the childhood lead testing from the pediatric center and went through meticulously, like, you know, not eating, not drinking. I think they were telling people, like, we decided it was nothing but coffee and wine until we figured this out. And they got the data and not solved the problem, but made sure this problem was something that people paid attention to.
Give that woman a Nobel, right? Relan, who would yours be?
I think another astronomer, just because that's my field, but Cecilia Payne Kapotchkin, in 1925, figured out that stars are mostly made of hydrogen and helium, and people didn't believe it for several years because she was just a young woman, graduate student, right? But 4 years later, it was confirmed by a man. And in retrospect, it's been called the most brilliant thesis ever written in astronomy.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and the work that she did on this, I mean, where was it done? And
she spent most of her career at Harvard.
Wow. Impressive. And what happens in that 4 years when you've put this theory out that you believe to be right and people are doubting you left and right until the man sweeps in? And
I have to tell you, most of the stories I've read and most of the women I've talked to who have experienced this tend to come to peace with it.
They, really?
I, at least externally, because I think they have to for their mental health.
How about you, Erin? You said scientists to watch, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to first give me a, we've got a few minutes, do you want to first give me a scientist we should know about to be admired that we don't?
One of my colleagues I really admire in my department, her name is Christy Haynes. She's doing an incredible number of different studies related to environmental toxicity of nanoparticles, but also biomedical research that incorporates these particles as a fundamental technology. And she recently was a principal investigator on work that has been shown to be important for the cryopreservation of tissues. And I just am amazed and inspired by, you know, the potential impacts that kind of work could have.
Right. So is she one of the scientists to watch as well? Okay. Who else? You said you had a couple.
Well, Rosalind Franklin was kind of the top on my list. But, you know, one of the classic examples is Marie Curie, who almost was left off of at least one of the Nobel Prizes, that one of the two that she ultimately was given. And it was actually, in this case, her husband, who was also on the Nobel Prize, was instrumental in making sure that her name made it on the list.
Hmm. Young scientist to watch.
I really like Chanda Prescott-Weinstein at University of Seattle is where she's at now. And she is a theoretical physicist. She studies dark matter, which is this stuff that makes up 80% of the universe and we can't observe it. And what she's doing is sort of thinking about ways that you could come up with to actually study the stuff we can't observe today, but that is super important to how the world works. And I think that's really interesting. I'm also really inspired by the activism she does about this intersection between science and society. So mm-hmm. the way I first found out about her was the work that she was doing supporting Native Hawaiians who were objecting to the construction of a telescope on Mauna Kea volcano.
Relan, how about you?
I think Lisa Randall, who's sort of broken the...
She is known, though.
Oh, that's not... Okay.
Well, I mean...
So my answer is disqualified.
I am not... I mean, she is, I think, one of the unusual examples that many of us have read her books, and she has an audience for her work, which unfortunately is the exception, right? Still kind of the exception rather than the rule. But for anybody who's listening who has not read Lisa Randall's books, get them, right?
Excellent.
She's great.
I agree.
Hey, thank you guys for a lively and interesting roundtable. Good to have you all here.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.